ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight calls for a childcare overhaul following revelations pedophiles are using the dark web to help get jobs working with children. Also, the worst storm of the year set to smash into Jamaica, bringing mayhem to the Caribbean nation. And a win for transgender young people and their families as a court overturns Queensland's controversial ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapies.
This has been a harrowing and traumatising ordeal. No teenager should ever have to go through something like this just to get the healthcare that they need.
First tonight, calls for an overhaul of the country's childcare system are growing following a Four Corners episode uncovering the extent of abuse taking place in the industry. Children's safety advocates and parent groups say a national commission is needed to orchestrate urgently needed reforms across the country, particularly in for-profit centres. Oliver Gordon reports.
The childcare business is booming. Today, chief executives from the industry fronted an inquiry into how the sector operates in New South Wales and asked whether she thinks not-for-profit childcare centres could meet current demand. Good Start Early Learning CEO Dr. Roz Baxter offered this.
Well, they certainly couldn't meet it tomorrow. The scale of it is such, when you've got three quarters of the sector for-profit, you couldn't simply flick a switch and think you could meet that demand.
But the surge in demand for childcare is being matched by growing questions about safety. Last night's Four Corners showed again that for-profit providers are overrepresented in child abuse and neglect statistics in early childcare. The program also uncovered fresh allegations about young children being groomed and how pedophiles have been working in the childcare sector, seemingly unchecked. The program has led to calls for reform. National Children's Commissioner Anne Hollands wants a cabinet minister dedicated to children's safety and a national commission set up to guide reforms to the sector.
The ministers have admitted that they waited too long to act on recommendations that were made even 10 years ago, and they are fast-tracking some of those recommendations now. But there are some questions that are still remaining, and that includes, why did it take so long?
The CEO of the Peak Body for Indigenous Children, Catherine Little, has called for changes to the funding model that allows for-profit childcare centres to thrive.
There has been no evidence that you ever get very good results when you prioritise profit over children, which is very distinctly different from the non-for-profit sector, which is about working with your community.
Greens Senator Steph Hodgkins-May agrees this part of the sector needs attention.
Labor and the Coalition keep talking about reform, but as far as we're concerned, as long as they continue to prop up the for-profit childcare model, nothing will change.
Good Start Early Learning Centre Chief Executive Dr. Roz Baxter naturally supports efforts to rid the childcare sector of bad actors, but says any changes need to be guided by a body that can ensure no child loses their place along the way.
There needs to be a proper system look at this, proper stewardship of this. Okay, if we are to get more serious about removing poor quality actors from the system, what is then the fail-safe to guarantee supply?
Last year, the federal government introduced legislation giving the Commonwealth power to cut off funding to childcare centres that don't meet the national quality standard. The legislation also allows officers to perform spot checks without warning to detect fraud and non-compliance. Health Minister Mark Butler says safety measures like CCTV and personal mobile phone bans are being rolled out in childcare centres too, but he concedes more needs to be done.
We've got no more important job as a government than lifting standards in the childcare sector to make sure every child is safe, that every educator working in every single centre is up to scratch. We've made it clear to centres if they're not up to scratch, they won't receive Commonwealth funding.
Georgie Dent runs advocacy group The Parenthood and says supporting the growth of not-for-profit centres is an important element of reform.
We believe that the funding model for early childhood education and care, the childcare subsidy, has driven a lot of the challenges that we're seeing today. We have got the proliferation of for-profit provision, not necessarily because they're in it because they want to educate and support children as best as possible, but because it has been an opportunity to profit.
How do we balance reform with the need for these centres?
We need to recognise that what has happened over the last 10 to 15 years is that the for-profit provision of early education and care has expanded without the necessary guardrails to ensure that that expansion is matched with appropriate oversight and regulation, so that any services that are growing are doing so from a high base. So they are delivering services at a high standard before they're able to expand.
She also supports calls for a national commission, but says increasing paid leave for parents should also be considered alongside sector-specific changes.
That will give parents more opportunity to stay at home in that first year of their child's life, which will make a meaningful difference to the lives of the children, but also to the parents.
That's Georgie Dent from advocacy group The Parenthood, Oliver Gordon reporting. And in a statement to PM, the Federal Early Childhood Education Minister, Jess Walsh, says the government is focused on keeping children safe, whether they attend a private or not-for-profit service, with actions to strengthen safety in the sector. It's been standing room only in a Queensland court, which has overturned a controversial ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapies for transgender children. In January, 3 months after the LNP government took office, the Health Department issued a directive banning the medicines for new young public patients with gender dysphoria. The court found the department's consultation was functionally irrelevant and that the decision was made during a 22-minute meeting. Emma Pollard has been at the Supreme Court and she joined me earlier. Emma, this decision follows a challenge by the mother of a trans teenager who argued the directive by the Health Department's Director General was unlawful. What reasons did the court give today?
Annie, Supreme Court Judge Peter Callaghan told the court the mother's challenge was successful and he was setting aside this health directive that bans these treatments in the public system. Now, in his written judgment, Justice Callaghan found the government's consultation with health services was not sufficient. Now, we know that that consultation amounted to a Teams meeting that lasted less than 30 minutes as the health minister was publicly announcing the ban. But Justice Callaghan did also make it clear that this finding related to the processes in issuing the health directive, not to, in his words, any review of the directive's merits.
And what does the ban mean for young trans Queenslanders now?
Well, outside the court in the pouring rain, trans rights supporters said this is a major win and they hope trans adolescents can now access puberty blockers and other medications in the public system. Matilda Alexander from LGBTI Legal Service read a statement from the mother who took the legal action because she can't be identified.
This has been a harrowing and traumatising ordeal. No teenager should ever have to go through something like this just to get the healthcare that they need. My child's medical treatment was ultimately decided by the government with no input by anyone with expertise in treating transgender young people.
That's Matilda Alexander from LGBTI Legal Service speaking outside Queensland's Supreme Court today. And Emma, how's the state government responded and is this now the end of the matter?
No, it's not the end of the matter. While the Health Minister, Tim Nicholls, says the government respects the court's decision, he says the government's concerns about puberty blockers are unchanged and it will consider its options for reinstating a ban, including potentially issuing a ministerial directive. Here's the Minister, Tim Nicholls.
The government's position remains unchanged. This direction, should I consider it appropriate, would implement a restriction on the provision of stage 1 treatment and stage 2 treatment to children and adolescents under 18 years of age with gender dysphoria. Patients who are already on a treatment plan will remain exempt.
Now, Annie, a separate challenge against the decision on anti-discrimination grounds is before the Queensland Civil and Administrative Tribunal.
And Emma, just to clarify, these medicines are allowed in every other state and territory public system, aren't they?
That's my understanding, yes. And also, to be clear, doctors in Queensland who are private doctors are still able to prescribe these medications. And trans adolescents who were already on these medications before the Health Service Directive came into place in late January have been able to continue taking them.
That's Emma Pollard. Questions are being asked about why a cruise ship passenger was left behind on a Great Barrier Reef island, where she was later found dead. The 80-year-old woman failed to reboard the ship and was reported missing on Saturday after the boat visited Lizard Island, where some of the tourists took a hike. The cruise ship company Coral Expeditions has described her death as tragic and says it's working closely with authorities. Lizzie Cramsey reports.
Mark Brimble has been an advocate for safety in the cruise ship industry ever since his ex-wife Diane died on a cruise ship almost two decades ago. He's devastated to hear of another death.
Any cruise ship that's taking people out onto the seas or international waters, no matter where they're going, are really taking the responsibility for the safety and security of that passenger, whether on the ship or off the ship. And I cannot understand why a ship would not have known that the person's not boarded and been able to attend to that matter quickly, especially when it was in such a small location like Lizard Island.
The woman, aged in her 80s, had been on the Coral Expeditions cruise visiting Lizard Island on Saturday, but was reported missing later that day after failing to reboard the ship. Her body was found by authorities today.
There should be an independent body that should be looking into it. From a federal state, I believe that the cruise industry is that large that it needs an ombudsman. Somebody that's independent to make sure that everything is being done to make sure that the safety and security of passengers is there.
It's believed the woman was taking part in an onshore excursion, hiking with a group, but stopped partway there while others continued to the top. The rest of the group returned to the vessel before realising the woman, who was travelling alone on the 60-day cruise, hadn't returned.
It's quite a steep climb. I believe it's about 359 metres above sea level.
Dr. Lyle Vale lived on the island for 35 years.
When you're climbing up, there's a reasonably well-established track, which Queensland Parks maintains very well. But they've made a deliberate decision not to make it just a paved path up there. They still want to preserve sort of the wilderness feel. So it's reasonably well marked, but there are spots on it that you do have to scramble up a bit.
He says the terrain can be challenging.
It's a granite island, but there's a lot of loose quartz on some parts of the trail. And they act like little marbles, little bearings. You know, it is pretty easy sometimes to lose your footings.
Coral Expeditions confirmed the death in a statement, saying the organisation is working closely with authorities. Queensland Police say a report will be prepared for the coroner.
Lizzie Cramsey. This is PM. I'm Annie Guest. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Hurricane Melissa is bearing down on the Caribbean, where a number of deaths have already been reported. The rare Category 5 storm is the strongest on the planet this year, packing winds of 280 kilometres per hour and maybe the biggest to ever hit Jamaica. Jamaicans are facing forecasts of catastrophic flash flooding, landslides and a life-threatening storm surge. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
Winds lashing the Jamaican capital, Kingston.
I have seen and heard that it's going to be very catastrophic.
It is not a joke. It is very serious, guys. And it is going to be something different. We think it will be astronomical. Yeah, it will be hard to digest when this is over.
It's the strongest storm on Earth this year.
What we have facing us is a major Category 5 hurricane.
That's Evan Thompson. He's the principal director at Jamaica's Meteorological Service. Category 5 is the maximum possible strength of a hurricane.
Central and eastern parishes would be inundated by the heaviest rainfall that would get up to 30 inches. We're talking about 750 millimeters of rainfall. We're not accustomed to measuring that.
Travelers visiting Jamaica warned by hotel staff to take shelter.
British tourist Toby Lindley-Smith and his family are heeding the advice.
Barricading the windows, trying to put mattresses up against them. As an emergency, you know, diving into the bathroom or into the shower, if it gets really bad and the windows blow out. For us Brits here, it's unprecedented.
It's not just the storm itself bringing anxiety, though. It's also the aftermath.
What will be the state of the island and the people here? So that's what we're all really worried about. And of course, ourselves. I have two small kids. So, yeah, not an ideal holiday, let's put it that way.
But the director of the US National Hurricane Center, Michael Brennan, believes those fears are warranted.
Catastrophic, life-threatening flash flooding and numerous landslides expected through Tuesday. The eyewall will bring destructive winds onshore, not just at the coast, but into mountainous areas as well. The forward speed of Melissa is going to increase and the eye is going to start to move very quickly across the island. And this is going to lead to widespread infrastructure damage, prolonged power outages, communication outages, and isolated communities. So it's going to be a very dangerous post-storm environment.
The National Hurricane Center has warned destructive winds may cause total structural failure. The storm surge inundation has the potential to be 2.5 to 4 metres. And it's not just Jamaica that will be impacted.
We are expecting Melissa, after it moves off the north coast of Jamaica, to make landfall in southeastern Cuba sometime overnight Tuesday night and Wednesday morning as a major hurricane. We have new hurricane warnings that have been issued for the central and southeastern Bahamas, expecting Melissa to move through those areas, especially the southeastern Bahamas, as a hurricane as we go from Wednesday afternoon into Wednesday night and Thursday.
For Haiti and the Dominican Republic, catastrophic flash flooding and landslides have been forecast, with the National Hurricane Center saying extensive infrastructural damage is expected in Haiti. In the capital, Port-au-Prince, residents of a camp for people displaced by gang violence are doing what they can to prepare. Fortune Vital is hammering tarps to his shack, but holds little hope.
We have nothing in our hands to live on. If a hurricane hits, we're screwed. If the hurricane comes on top of all the problems we already have, we'll simply die.
According to the United Nations, there are around 250 sites housing internally displaced people in Haiti, all bracing for the storm's arrival.
Tanya Dendrinos. Venezuela has accused the United States of plotting an attack on its own Navy warship docked in the Southern Caribbean. The American warship USS Gravely has been anchored in Venezuela's neighbouring country, Trinidad and Tobago, for military exercises for the last few days. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Almost three decades of tension between the United States and its Caribbean neighbours are coming to a head. Venezuela today accusing the CIA of being behind a plot to attack its own country's warship anchored in nearby Trinidad in order to blame Venezuela's leader and justify aggression on the country. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Ivan Gil said in a statement he had advised Trinidad and Tobago of the alleged false flag operation.
On our territory, a criminal cell financed by the CIA and linked to this covert operation is being dismantled.
The allegation comes a day after Venezuela claimed it had arrested four mercenaries it alleged were connected to the US intelligence agency. Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez spoke at a press conference.
It was reported that a false flag operation was underway due to the arrest of a group of people linked to the CIA who have already provided sufficient information for us to go out to the country and the international community to denounce this new provocation that seeks to escalate the United States' aggression against Venezuela.
Locals recorded video of the US-guided missile destroyer, the USS Gravely, arriving in Trinidad for joint military exercises on Sunday. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, not happy with the alliance, announcing he's suspending gas exploration agreements with Trinidad and Tobago in response to the Caribbean country allowing US warships to dock at its capital. He spoke on Venezuelan government television.
Faced with the Prime Minister's threat to turn Trinidad and Tobago into the aircraft carrier of the US Empire against Venezuela, I am immediately suspending all energy agreements and everything agreed upon in this area. It is a precautionary measure that I have the power to take as president, and I have already approved and signed it.
The US has already launched several airstrikes on vessels in the Caribbean Sea, alleging they were involved in drug trafficking, killing 43 people. US President Donald Trump says the mounting military campaign in international waters was against alleged drug traffickers in Latin America. But Venezuela claims the US is working to oust President Nicolas Maduro. Dr. Raul Sanchez-Uribarri is an expert in international partnerships at La Trobe University.
This is the last instance of a saga that has already unfolded over the course of several weeks, tensions building up between the United States and the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro. What I see right now is clearly building pressure on the Maduro regime that would create frictions or possible fragmentation of the Maduro regime within, in which case we would be looking at the argument, of course, of regime change.
The Venezuelan-born academic points out there's been a long history of tension between the two countries.
The tensions actually increase with subsequent to Chavez's arrival in power in 1999, and especially after Nicolas Maduro's arrival in power in 2013.
While there's no hard evidence the CIA was involved in an alleged plot, Dr. Sanchez-Uribarri fears the allegations could provoke violence.
The uncertainty of the situation and the relative speed with which things have progressed in the past weeks, of course, a likely scenario could be targeted attacks.
That's Dr. Raul Sanchez-Uribarri from La Trobe University, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. If you're out on the water in the Northern Territory, you're just as likely to pass a boat full of men as you are women. It's the only place in the country where there's equal participation in the sport. A new research out of the Top End reveals how women fishers there broke through the stereotypes and what barriers still remain. Angus Randall reports.
It's the first study of its kind in the Top End. Women fishers asked about their experiences tossing in a line as they partake in a pastime often regarded as the domain of the blokes. Author Dr. Jenny House is from Charles Darwin University.
We were able to kind of look at people's stories and, you know, hear from their real life experiences on the water, on the boat ramp, you know, day to day in the community. We can see that there's some really positive changes. In the last 20 years, the participants really talked about how there's been this huge shift in the prevalence of women involved in recreational fishing through better representation in the media, the high-profile women's comps.
Figures from 2 years ago show women's participation in fishing has just outpaced men in the territory. 33% of women are involved, compared to 32% of men. Dr. House wanted to look beyond the numbers and found despite the NT's success, there are still barriers to equality.
A lot of women also shared stories of being, you know, harassed, bullied, or experiencing discrimination or being represented differently because they're women.
Dr. House says the financial benefits of breaking down these barriers would be immense.
These stereotypes are really stopping people from getting involved in rec fishing, which in turn is limiting the spending that they're putting into the industry. It's limiting the businesses that have the potential to grow in the sector. And it's also limiting, you know, basically half of the potential audience of this sector and of the businesses involved in it. Catering better for women in this industry not only is better for women, for the community, for families who are fishing, but it's also better for the businesses themselves and for the industry more broadly.
And she says it's up to everyone to create that change.
A lot of the women who were part of the study talked about how important the men in their lives and the men in the sector have been, especially those who've been supportive and advocating for encouraging women in this sector and to have a good experience.
David Chiravolo is the CEO of AFANT, the Northern Territory's peak body for recreational fishing. He says fishing is so ingrained in the culture of the Top End, it's moved past some of these outdated stereotypes.
A key thing is that fishing in the Northern Territory is absolutely mainstream. It is a core activity, one in three people going fishing. And then look, we do have face some challenges. We've got crocodiles, we've got big tides, and so it's not necessarily the easiest place in Australia to go fishing. So it's all the more remarkable that we have such high levels of participation.
David Chiravolo says he's noticed a shift over the years from the idea of dad and the boys on the boat to entire families and groups of friends taking to the water.
The main reasons people actually go fishing is to spend time with one another, to spend time with people who they care about, to get out in nature, and to become connected with places and the environment. And it's something that everybody can share in. There are still barriers, and we do need to work to address those barriers and make fishing as inclusive as we can. And I think people really need to focus on making sure that fishing is a family-friendly activity, because it is inherently a family-friendly activity.
That's David Chiravolo from the Northern Territory's peak body for recreational fishing, ending Angus Randall's report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Annie Guest. The podcast of the full PM program is available on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is on the move, throwing his weight around in Asia. But will he have the upper hand when he sits down with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, later this week? Today, Global Affairs editor Laura Tingle on why Trump won't be the most powerful man in the room. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.